Hey, y'all, how's it going? Oh, yeah? Oh, that's good.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sorry I had to miss the show yesterday. Something came up. It's all right. What in the world? Oh, my God. Boy, you know, keeping CNN International on out of the corner of my eye all day long, it's just about enough to drive me mad. Oh, I just can't stand. Oh, I just can't do MSNBC or Fox News or regular CNN for that matter. And believe me, I can't stand that Christiane Amanpour, but God, at least she knows how to read and she lies about subjects that are important instead of in the whole wide world. I can't imagine how those parents must be feeling. Can you imagine? But this is a job for the U.S. federal police? Really? Really? Now, I can see, you know, in a minarchist world, the U.S. government very publicly recommending that the government of Nigeria do their supposed job. Hey, we're pretending to be security forces. So the hostage rescue team flew in, they tracked him down, and then they just put a bullet in his head. They didn't even say, like, hey, freeze, or anything. And so my thing is this, that guy surely deserved to have a bullet in his head. There's no question. Okay, well, I'll put it this way. If anyone deserved to be killed, he was one of them. But the problem is granting that kind of authority to the FBI. That if somebody's wanted for kidnapping, that just go ahead and put a bullet in their brain because they're better off dead anyway. And now that's your job. Here's your license to kill. In this case, they didn't say, oh, he had a gun. He was pointing it at them. He was much closer to the hostage and was running toward the hostage to kill the hostage or nothing like that. They just said, oh yeah, the HRT, yeah, they hunted the guy down, killed him. Heroes. And again, he deserved to die, but get a single boot on the ground over there cleaning up their terrorism problem. In fact, you may remember what, I don't know, a year and a half ago, Hillary Clinton was spouting off. Okay, I'm guessing on the year and a half. But it was when Hillary was still the Secretary of State. And it wasn't just her statements. There was some State Department official policy position paper, something, something that had gone forward talking about the international terrorist threat of Boko Haram in Nigeria. And the Nigerian government said, hey, farm bills in the U.S. Congress. And then after you hear her speak, you will know better. In fact, you may already know better. You'll extra, super, special, no better after you hear Marcy Wheeler explain. She's Empty Wheel online, emptywheel.net, the great Marcy Wheeler. And Jeff Stein is going to be on the show. Friend of the family, guess I could say. And Jeff Stein has a new piece about Israelis spying in America. Israel won't stop to Harry Brown talking. And it was him running for president in 1996, back when I first came across him. Could have been that very speech, actually, for all I know. And it just got me thinking about, you know, the counterfactual about would if Harry Brown had been elected back in the year 2000, or 96, or 2000, or what he would have to say about the situation with Russia right now. That's the most important one. There's a lot of them, but anyway. If you don't know too much about liberal role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right hand. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got so much news, I just don't even know what to do with it all here, man. I'll try to talk about it little. Yeah, right. I'll try to just get through it here. So, exclusive, CIA falls back in Afghanistan, and this is about the, who the hell was it we were talking with last week about this? The CIA, backed, desk. Two U.S. officials said the CIA-trained paramilitaries at the Kunar base have been told of their imminent firing, and some have already reached out to the Taliban, possibly to reach a peace deal for when they no longer have Americans to pay or protect them. So, you know, I don't know, man. I think, I doubt it's the plan, but I think America's war in Afghanistan might just be wrapping up here. Because you've got people at these agencies, I mean, and this may not even be true, you know. And I guess they didn't say that all CIA officers are packing up their bags and leaving. They're not saying that. But they're saying that they're basically calling off their support and their mission of supporting these local militias that they've raised up here. And so, good luck, Afghanistan. With all the new warlords that we've created for you there. Oh, yeah, it was Anand Gopal. That's who we were talking about. And I was saying, yeah, so what about Hekmatyar? And he says, what about now there's 1,000 Hekmatyars? There are a whole new generations of warlords, mobsters and criminals and murderers and would-be dictators all over the place in Afghanistan now. Not that I'm saying you got to stay to somehow make it better, because that's stupid. That's how it got like this in the first place. The American people know better than that by now. But in D.C., they still don't. Got to make myself clear just in case somebody in D.C. is listening. I'm not saying fix it. I'm saying stop fixing it. You suck at fixing it. Okay, good. All right. That's funny. Where the hell is my Libya section? I'm going to have to find the other one because I got another Libya story here somewhere. But this one is Eli Lake. So many jihadists are flocking to Libya. It's becoming scumbag Woodstock. Leaders from at least three of Al-Qaeda's most virulent affiliates are now in Libya. What are they planning there? Well, they're going to kill people more. And then, where the hell's my other Libya story? Oh, yeah. Daniel Larrison is good on this, man. Of course. Daniel Larrison at the American Conservative. The Libyan war was a blunder from the start. And he quotes the Washington Post saying, blaming Obama and Congress for overthrowing Gaddafi and then failing to establish security and build a new political order there. Larrison says they must be joking. They must be kidding. Congress might usefully probe why the administration allowed a country in which it initiated military operations to slide into chaos. Well, as we covered at the time and ever since, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was in on the war all along. These were the Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys. These were the Libyans who went and fought in the war. Abdul Hakim al-Belhaj was open about it. And so was Hasidi was his name, was interviewed in the freaking Telegraph in the UK. Yeah, me and my buddies, yeah, a lot of us were veterans of the Iraq War, you know, fighting against the Americans. But, you know, bygones, bygones, guys, thanks very much for the help. We appreciate it. Really? And Belhaj actually sued the British. Why did Belhaj, the Al-Qaeda guy, who was an actual Al-Qaeda guy, who had fought with Zarqawi's legions, I don't know, legions, had fought with Zarqawi's group in Iraq, and had fought with the Taliban in Afghanistan, in both cases against the Americans. And then, oh no, I can't believe that a regime change for the jihadists, which included a Petraeus scheme to funnel Gaddafi's old weapons to the other jihadists in Syria, including Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys there as well, blew up in the State Department's face on September 11th, 2012, in the Benghazi attack. And I swear, this is like somewhere in the annals of media criticism, and maybe even like at a university level here, there could be a study done about the disconnect between the coverage and the reality of these situations, where you literally have America fighting for Al-Qaeda. And where you literally have the... And in front of everybody's face, and where you literally have the Republicans, including, I guess, most of the base, right? The conservative movement in America, obsessed with this event at the Benghazi, you know, makeshift so-called consulate there, State Department office there, where the ambassador was killed and his bodyguards and some CIA guys at the annex later and all that. And yet are completely, apparently, are willing to consider the entire events of that day in a total vacuum. Everything else is equal there. There's no question of why did America have a consulate and a giant CIA station in Benghazi? How long had it been there? What were they up to? What's the big deal? Oh, so Gaddafi's one virtue in the whole world was that he liked to kill Al-Qaeda guys, huh? Well, anyway, nope. You know what's the scandal is that it's just too bad the military couldn't come and save the day. But as Robert Gates said, yeah, this isn't a movie. We don't save days. You know, we ruin them. We don't, all this stuff about honoring your buddies and leave no man behind and all that. Yeah, right. Tell that to a bunch of officers in their fancy little costumes, their fancy little costume jewelry. Rush in there and save them, guys. Yeah, they're racing right over. Got your back, man. Anyway, I mean, and that's bad, but I'm just saying, in context of an entire war for the jihadists in Libya, yeah, it doesn't really make too much sense. And then Larrison here reminds us that there was no support whatsoever in America for building up an army and creating a democracy and all of this crap. They barely got away with calling it a humanitarian no-fly zone, which, as I warned you, would immediately translate into a regime change. Since, hey, if you need a no-fly zone, then what you're saying is the people of eastern Libya will never be secure without your protection as long as Gaddafi's in power in Tripoli. You don't even need to do like one, two, skip a few. It's just one. Next is regime change, Gaddafi in Tripoli. Pretty obvious. But anyway, so it's interesting that Eli Lake is on this trip now. Noted warmonger. There very well could be an agenda to now double down on the Libyan intervention, go in there and host some purple-fingered elections and make things right. You ready to volunteer for that one? Better than fighting in Ukraine, I'd guess. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Michael E. Bell, Sr. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you doing?
How are you, Scott? Thank you for having me on your show today.
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us today, and I'm pretty sure most people in this audience saw this headline, and I'm pretty sure that to a man and woman, they probably pretty much felt the same way about it as I did. Governor Walker signs police custody deaths bill. And this is in Wisconsin. And this law says that anytime someone dies in police custody or is shot out, you know, in the course of their duties out there in the neighborhood or whatever it is, that it must be investigated by an outside authority, I guess, which would not include internal affairs even from the same police agency. It would have to be another police agency of some kind brought in. And this is absolutely humongous. I mean, this... And I'll ask you about all the details here in a minute, but just for the precedent set that actually, you know what, even if people absolutely, you know, love the cops and think that they're all heroes and it's the world's most dangerous job and they're just keeping us safe, the truth is that still there has to be accountability and regulating themselves, each department regulating itself and their closest prosecutors. It is just, it's proven to be problematic, I think. Most people agree. I don't think it's a partisan issue or anything. I think people now, we're coming to a consensus about this, and you are really just leading the way on what can be done, at least for a start here. This is just humongous, and so thank you on behalf of all freedom-loving people in America. This is so important, and thank you very much.
You're welcome, and also it's just not me. It's a group in addition to myself. Mm-hmm. Also, we had to have some very bold legislators that were willing to take a try at this, and we were able to navigate the system, and we were able to get the bill passed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were able to create a consensus among the interested political parties and associated groups and interests and so forth in your state to go ahead and agree that, yeah, this really is the right thing to do. Let's all go ahead and get on the right side of this thing. And that is just monumental right there. So that, I guess, I'm going to make sure and double underline how you did this in my notes here. But let's rewind to the beginning of how it was that you got involved. And I'm sorry, I know it's a sad story. I won't ask you to tell it in any more detail than you want, but it's important for people to understand.
Well, I'll try to make it as brief as possible. Essentially, I had a son. He was 21 years old. He was out with a night out with friends. He had no criminal record. He was a college student. He came home from that night out with friends. He was under the influence, but the blood alcohol showed that he was at 0.13, which is under the influence, but not over the top or anything like that. Pulled over in front of his house. Officer gets out of his car, starts accusing my son of doing some wrongdoing, of running a stoplight or speeding or whatever. And you can see through the dash cam video of the officer's vehicle that my son drove perfectly straight and stopped at the stop sign and stopped in front of his house. Within a very short time, my son's like, well, you know, no, I did, and I didn't, you know, I didn't do that. And, you know, you're accusing me of something I didn't do. There was a scuffle. My son was, you can hear him say something like, hey, why are you kicking me? Quit kicking me. My son has moved off camera, and within a very short time, he's tased, and then he runs to the back of his own home. A number of officers are back there. My son's mother and my daughter run downstairs, see a Rodney King-style beating occurring on my 21-year-old son in the backyard. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was under a spotlight. There were a number of eyewitnesses. One officer screamed out in frantic, he has my gun. The eyewitnesses said, no, he doesn't. His hands are behind his back. And then another officer walks up, places a gun directly to my son's head and fires a shot right in into his temple and kills him on the spot. I actually didn't die on the spot. He died on the Flight for Life helicopter from our city to a central hospital in the middle of the state. I'm a retired Air Force officer, and I was a pilot, and I understood safety investigations. And so I allowed this to work itself out so we can find the details. Essentially, the officers cleared themselves of wrongdoing within 48 hours, before witness statements were taken, before the autopsy was complete, before crime lab reports came in. These officers rallied around each other and said that they did a review and that the shooting was justified. And the DA also said the shooting was justified. we try to make a claim. You know, we like, hey, there's a problem here. You know, these eyewitnesses and so forth seen something, and these officers are saying one thing, and they're completely disregarding any of the eyewitness statements. So eventually, we filed a lawsuit in civil and federal court, settled for about $1.75 million. I refused to accept a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement because it was always my intent to be able to tell my son's story. Typically, in these cases, if there is some type of settlement, the documents are sealed forever, and whatever went wrong remains hidden from the public. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't long after that that from day one, we questioned the review process because it was the polar opposite of my Air Force experience. But we ended up campaigning. We took out major ads in New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, so forth. We bought television ads. But what really turned out to be very successful is we ran 12 by 48 billboards along the major interstates in the state of Wisconsin. And essentially, it was a large smoking gun, and it said the words, "When police kill, should they judge themselves?" And it sent them to our son's website, michaelbell.info. And at one point, we had 43 of those billboards up in Milwaukee in protest of another shooting that was very questionable. Actually, it wasn't even a shooting. It was a young man died in the backseat of a squad car as he was begging for assistance because he couldn't breathe, and he was being mocked by the police officers that were on the scene. He ended up suffocating, and that whole thing could be seen in the dash cam video. So our family kept working on this. You have to understand that I am not against law enforcement, that I am a military officer. I did have law enforcement on occasion under my command, and we know that many times the law enforcement can be our heroes. But I was appalled by a system that didn't have checks and balances, and I kept thinking, if I have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy killed under a spotlight with five eyewitnesses and his hands handcuffed behind his back, and a police officer kills him, and we cannot get anybody to listen to us, what must it be like for the Asian family, the African-American family, the Hispanic family, or any of those groups out there that don't have the means or resources that we did? So eventually, I brought my case to a legislator. His name was Gary Bies, and he's actually a retired chief deputy sheriff in the state of Wisconsin. And I showed him what occurred in our case, and I showed him what occurred in a number of other high-profile cases in Wisconsin, and we started crafting a bill, and it was called AB 409. We had the first public hearing of its type in the nation, and it was an overflow crowd. And essentially, law enforcement came on board because the good officers recognized that there needed to be some checks and balances, and some departments were causing a lot of negative publicity for other law enforcement departments in the state. So that's how our story happened in a nutshell for you, Scott.
I see. Well, you know, that very last thing you said there sounds like an important point. Some of the police departments, the other departments felt, were making them look bad, were costing them their credibility. And so they were saying, we welcome accountability since we're not worried about it, but we want that department two counties away from here cleaned up because they're screwing up our business here in our county. Is that right? And so that was part of how they got on board?
That's exactly right.
That's very important strategically speaking. I mean, I don't know if that was just happenstance in this case, but that's very important because, of course, you know, what do these different county sheriff's departments or city police departments owe each other in terms of loyalty? Not when, you know, if you're the Houston PD and the Dallas PD screw-ups are making you look bad all day, every day. That ought to be a good thing for us to try to turn them against each other. It ought to work pretty well.
Well, we provided the opening on the outside and a number of good officers on the inside that respect their profession and knew that there was an opportunity to clean it up, helped on the inside. Mm-hmm. And eventually the bill had the support from the five major police unions in the state of Wisconsin.
Wow. All five major police unions supported it.
That's correct.
Wow. Wow. I hope somebody smarter and more plugged into me is taking notes during this interview like I am. I mean, this is incredible to think that the police unions, well, I mean, I can see why. Hey, they're trying to look clean at least, so Good. And before we we're headed out to this break here, well, pretty soon. So probably don't have time for any more questions for this segment until we get back, and I do have a lot of them. But I just wanted to mention something that a very wise man that I know mentioned to me, which is that something that's changing in America is that the police are becoming more and more militarized, and they're trained in more and more aggressive ways. And to treat regular people, not even real suspected criminals, but just regular people, even suspected of drunk driving, treating them like they're all the most hardened criminals in the world, enemies and all of that, at the very same time that everyone has a telephone with a camera in their pocket, and at the very same time that everybody's connected on Facebook. So every one of these stories on the local level becomes a national news story. And so this is blowing up into a huge scandal, police abuse in America right now. And, you know, I think they better get out ahead of the parade like you're talking about, because there's some accountability on the grand scale coming here soon. We'll be right back with Michael Bell Sr., who's done this great work in Wisconsin, right after this.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Sorry about that, y'all. Two speech spots right in a row like that. Well, that's not supposed to do that. A little fine-tuning. It'll be fine. All right. Listen, we're talking with Michael Bell Sr. And his website here, I have it, michaelbell.info. Michaelbell.info. And that's his name. That's also was his son's name. And I'm sorry, sir, I asked you to give that lengthy description, so you told your whole story there, and then from at the end of it, I started at the end and something you said about getting the cops to support your bill and all of that, but it's not where I meant to start. I meant to start at saying I'm so sorry about what happened to your son. I can't imagine that happening, how horrible it must have been, and especially, you know, to die that way and everything, and it's great that I don't think you put it this way, but I know from reading about your story that you took the entire settlement that you got from the lawsuit and you put it all toward this campaign for accountability, require an unbiased police review process. And that's just heroic, and it's great, and you're writing American history here. I mean, it's just huge. I couldn't state how huge it is, and it's just the beginning, because they're not going to repeal this. They can't, and other states are sure to follow suit. This is going to become a trend, I sure hope, and it could really change things in a major way. And and it's still just, I guess, it's asking other cops to look at it, but still at least they're other cops, not the very same agencies. Could you please tell us about exactly what the law says, how this is supposed to work? The state police investigate the locals, the state, or what?
Well, originally the first version of the bill asked for three parts. The first is that if an officer is involved in the loss of a civilian's life, that we make sure that that officer was in a clear frame of mind. There are no requirements in the state of Wisconsin that if an officer takes your life, that you can check to see if he was under the influence of alcohol or under the influence of a painkiller or something like that. And when I talk to the good officers, they say, take my arm and take a blood sample because I have no problem with this whatsoever. And I was appalled. Now, here I am, an Air Force pilot, that I knew that the first thing that they would do if you were involved in some type of military aviation crash would be to take some type of blood sample. And if you're a truck driver driving down the road, you're involved with a crash, they take a breathalyzer. If you're involved in any type of factory accident, they do the same thing. But if you're a police officer, you're not required to give any type of indication whether you are in a clear frame of mind or not. So our first version of the bill asked for that. The second version, or the second part of the bill, was if you're involved in a police-involved fatality, that you, your department, cannot investigate yourselves. What they were doing in the state of Wisconsin was called internal organizational review. And our family was saying that this is inappropriate because you're all working under the same chief and he controls everything. You're going to control the investigation and the review process and the decisions. And we looked at, in 129 years, since the police and fire commissions were founded in Wisconsin in 1885, that we could not find a police department that ever ruled any of its shootings unjustified. In fact, we couldn't find a police and fire commission or an inquest that ever found an officer unjustified in taking someone's life in 129 years. And we felt that that was an impossible record of perfection. And we did find in 2005, there was a district attorney in Milwaukee that actually charged an officer in wrongdoing, but that department had found itself justified, and an inquest had also found that officer justified, but it was citizens that brought additional information to that DA, and that DA finally charged that officer. So the second part of the bill is what's called external professional review, that people from outside the department that don't have any close ties to anybody in that department come in there and conduct a professional review of what the incident occurred. The third part of the bill that we looked for was an independent review of that, but just not by law enforcement, because law enforcement has an institutional stake in the process. And many times if you're, let's say, a lieutenant or a sergeant in a police force and you rule against somebody else, your career might be in jeopardy. So we asked that a group of law professionals, just not law enforcement, come in and review that incident and hand their decision to the DA. And that board has to be appointed by a high-ranking elected official. And we were looking at law scholars, like a criminal justice professor or a criminal law professor. We looked at a retired district attorney, and we looked at retired police chiefs, so that they had a voice on this board, too. But a respected review panel would look at this shooting or this loss of life and then give a valued opinion to the district attorney, because the district attorney relies so heavily on law enforcement that many times that they don't want to risk that relationship by charging an officer. So those were the three looking for, but we only got number two. And number two was this, is that there is, if there's a law enforcement-involved fatality, that investigators from outside that department have to come in and conduct the investigation, they have to lead the investigation, and then they're going to have to issue a report to the DA. And if the DA finds that there were no criminal behaviors regarding the officers involved, then he must release that report to the public. In addition to that, one of the things that was important to us is when my son got killed, we approached the governor, we approached the attorney general, we approached the FBI, the U.S. attorney, and nobody would give us the time of day. The only way that we could even navigate the system was to get an attorney. And if that's happening to an educated family, we can't imagine what it would happen to other families that might be involved. And so the current law, AB 409, states that a police department, if they're involved in the loss of life, they have to give kind of a blueprint of what that family can do to go ahead and seek guidance or seek recourse against the officers involved if they need to. So that was the victory that we scored on AB 409 on April 23rd of this year.
Great. Okay, now I just want to make sure I understood you right there. You said, I think maybe I didn't understand you right. Did you say that number two, the most important part of it, but did you say that was the only one that you actually got through? The rest was cut out, or I misunderstood?
Yeah, yes, that was the only part that we got through. And I'll tell you why. The first part, even though every one of us agrees that if an officer is involved in a loss of life, that there probably should be some type of breathalyzer or blood sample taken just to make sure that there was no problem. Mm-hmm. the law enforcement agencies said, well, you know, that is, we are infringing upon our rights. We are, you know, we are, I can't remember the exact term that they use, but essentially that we were incriminating ourselves if we give a blood sample. And we knew that that the legislative session was short and that this whole bill could be bogged down with that, and we felt it was such an important item that if need be, we can come back and get that at a later date. So that was removed from the original version of the bill.
Not much of an excuse on their behalf. If it's part of the contract, if it's part of the deal for being a public servant, then it's part of the deal. There's a lot of other things that they you know, sign away the right to do as well, as long as they're in that job. Like going out and getting arrested on assault charges for a bar fight on Saturday night, too, right?
I agree with you 100%, and I think that's something that we can come back and get at a later date.
I'm sorry, we're short on time. I hate to interrupt you, but when it comes to this independent investigation, it is the most important part, but who is this independent person? He's not the internal affairs. He's somebody else, but he works for the mayor, or he works for the county, or he works for the state, or and who's he answerable to?
What's really interesting about this is that you can actually have, for the first time, probably civilians reviewing law enforcement, because the independent investigator could work for the medical examiner's office. The independent investigator could work for the police and fire commission or some type of civilian review board. It doesn't have to be law. Obviously, they'll have law enforcement experience, but that investigator can be determined by the department or departments in the county or at a or in the state itself. And law enforcement is working that out now. So they're not working.
Are you worried that maybe you've given them too much leeway there and they're just going to find a way around this that way?
My belief is this, is that the experts in the system will always find a way to subvert it at some point in time. But it is a step forward. Our family was not afforded this opportunity. We wanted outside review. We did not get it. And like I said, eventually we won a $1.75 million settlement, and I think that in itself, even though the city says that that doesn't say that they did anything wrong, I think that just the dollar amount themselves against law enforcement shows that there was a problem.
Yeah, no, sorry, and don't get me wrong. I don't mean to be overly critical about that. I just... I want to make sure I understand the details, basically. But I think what you've done here is just absolutely huge, Michael. I think it sets a great precedent for the future. And after all, like you're saying, no matter what people think of cops, if you can think the greatest of them, but hey, we still need checks and balances. Even George Washington needed checks and balances. That's the way it goes in America. So, you know, my greatest of luck to you, my thanks to you, and my best of luck to you in further reforms along these lines. And thank you very much for your time on the show today, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And if people are interested in, once again, michaelbell.info, my son's story's there.
Right.
And also join us on Facebook at Plea for a Change. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And again, everybody, that's michaelbell.info. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at APSRadioNews.com and at DailyPaulRadio.com and at ScottHorton.org. Anomaly Radio. I'm all over the place, man. Yeah. All right, next up is the great Marcy Wheeler. Empty Wheel is what they call her online. EmptyWheel.net. Oh, I hit the wrong button. Welcome to the show, Marcy. How are you doing?
Don't hit the wrong button.
I did hit the wrong button. I got to turn you up. You're too quiet.
Hi,
how are you?
Never too quiet. I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for joining us. You sound great on Skype. It worked. And you can hear me, apparently. So that's good, too. All right. So we got how many different NSA reform bills in the Congress right now? Two or three?
Well, technically, if you count Dianne Feinstein's, three. What used to be the good one, USA Freedom Act, has become the crummier one that I'm calling USA Freedom Act.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is what I've come to understand here. Oh, and now I see that the one I'm looking at is no longer the latest. Rats. The one I read, still very detailed. I understood most of it, I think. New freedom equals less protection for all but the telecoms. Yeah, of course. What'd you call us? Regular schlubs? Yeah, we don't get any protection at all. The USA Freedom Act. All right, so this was, help refresh my memory. This was Jim Sensenbrenner, who was the original sponsor of the Patriot Act, who got mad at the way that they twisted his Section 215 all out of whack. Is that right?
That's what he said, yeah.
Uh-huh. But then he's not really standing up for what he originally wrote now.
Well, what happened partly was that the House intelligence leaders, so John Boehner, were threatening to go around the House Judiciary Committee through the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, Dutch Ruppersberger. I teasingly call their bill the Ruppraj bill, kind of like Scooby-Doo, Ruppraj. But so they were going to break jurisdictional rules and go through Intelligence Committee. And that made everyone in the House Judiciary Committee a lot more willing to negotiate and to come up with a bill which is better than the House Intelligence bill, but not all that much better. And then they're going to mark it up tomorrow, and we're going to see whether the there are real progressives on House Judiciary Committee. There's like maybe one on the House Intelligence Committee, and no, you know, there's no real critics of the dragnet on the House Intelligence Committee. So, we're better off House Judiciary, but they've already given away the farm, and you know, a lot of key parts of this bill are just like the House Intelligence bill. Now.
All right. Well, okay. So first of all, actually, first of all, I'll ask you to, if possible, back off your microphone just a little bit. Sound pretty good, but could be a little better if you could back off your microphone. But you're coming in loud and clear, though, so don't worry about that. Then the other thing is, okay, so first of all, could you tell us what was good about the Freedom Act before it became the Freedom Act in the first place and what it is that they're now dropping out and writing over?
Some of the things they did were the question is, how are you going to get the government to stop bulk collection, right? What kind of language can you write that's actually going to stop the intelligence community that kind of runs on its own power? And that original one tried to say that you can only get information if you actually tie it to actual people who you are actually investigating. This one, the Freedom Act and the House Intelligence Bill, both adopted different means of trying to shut down bulk collection. And they say you have to use a selector. But they don't define selector. Nowhere. They never define it. Elsewhere, they like to say it's things like email addresses or phone numbers. But we know they're using more broadly than that. And the way they use the language, there's nothing to prevent them from using, say, area code 202, the area code for all of D.C., as their selector. They just don't define it. So that's one thing, is they've moved from actually tying it to investigations to tying it to selectors, which can be very broad.
Which is, yeah, again, that's just the general warrant, and so give up the whole store right there, right off the bat, right?
Yeah, they say it's not. And this is, I did, my last piece was a piece noting that the claim that this is not bulk collection, because you and I consider it bulk collection, you and I consider it a general warrant, the government says so long as they use a selector, it's not bulk collection. It's only bulk collection if they get everybody's phone calls, everybody's phone records, right? Which is convenient for them, but not really convincing to me, nor should it be to any of your listeners.
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of the other important things that got dropped from USA Freedom Act. One, it tried, I'm not sure would have been successful, but it tried to prevent what are called backdoor searches. So in other words, it tried to say, if you collect this information and you want to go get the U.S. person content in there, you have to go get a warrant. And that's what a lot of people are saying, but the government doesn't want to do that, and so that's out. That's been thrown out of
USA. Wait a minute now. So that part of it, Is that then in reference to the corporate store where once they've collected something under whatever pretext, that once they've got it through whichever loophole that they've used, now it's all open season for anything once it's in that category from now on? And this was an attempt to limit that. Is that correct?
No. This was actually an attempt to limit content access. So, when they collect, if they collect the content from, say, Nasir al-Awlaki's phone calls, that's Anwar al-Awlaki's father. We know he was in contact with a number of journalists. We know he was in contact with the ACLU when they were representing him. Mm-hmm. So say they collect all of his content, right? All of his, phone calls, all of his email address, emails that he sends. The government can go in and get to what the ACLU has written to him, or get to what journalist Jeremy Scahill has said to him on the phone, without needing any reasonable articulable suspicion that they have a tie, that they're supporting Anwar al-Awlaki or anything like that. The government can go in and say, we have a foreign intelligence purpose to see these conversations between journalists and lawyers and this guy that we've targeted because his son is a creep. And we can just go in and access it.
So which door is the back door? What's the loophole that they're using to say that he's the father of a guy that they accused once?
They argue, and this is, this is based off of when they get a warrant for somebody's file cabinet and say, we suspect there are bad things in this file cabinet. When they go through the file cabinet, if they find other evidence of crime, they can sort of use it, depending on how narrowly everything was written.
So they're tapping the father in order to try to get at the son, but as long as we're tapping the father, we have all this information about Scahill, about the CCR and the ACLU, and whoever else the father was in contact with.
So long,
because they announced they were going to kill him before they killed him, quite a while before they killed him. So I'm sure there was plenty to investigate once Awlaki's father, the grandfather, really got to work trying to prevent his son from being assassinated.
Right.
I'm two hops from a lot of these guys. One hop.
Yeah, I mean, I used him as a specific example because you and I both. We can talk about the specifics of it, but the general rule that they are applying here is so long as they have legally collected information. So they could be collecting all of Yemen, all of Yemen's, all of email involving Yemen, right? Mm-hmm. So long as they've legally collected that, they argue they don't need additional legal process to go back in and access any of it.
I see.
And I actually did a post a couple weeks ago where it took a slide that Snowden leaked, and it showed that one of the things they do when they're trying to figure out, they get a bunch of metadata and they want to figure out which stuff is more interesting to read. There's this computer screen that pulls up the metadata that they found with all of the interesting conversations that person has had. So, they'll pull up Scott Horton and they'll say, golly, you had an interesting conversation with this guy in Mexico 6 months ago. And not only will that show the conversation, right? So not only will they be able to just kind of from one source be able to pull up all the interesting conversations you've ever been involved with, but it includes a link right to the content. So, they can say, golly, that guy in Mexico is a creep. I wonder what the heck Scott said to him, and immediately link through without getting a warrant, without having any reason to believe that you are a creep just like the guy in Mexico. They can get right through to the content. I mean, they have to, for you as persons, for you and me, they'd have to make, there's an additional hoop. But it's an internal hoop. It's not actually going to a court or even, again, they have said very explicitly they do not require even reasonable articulable suspicion mm-hmm. to do these backdoor searches.
And again, this was anything. To be fixed in the USA Freedom Act, but now it is not.
Now it's not.
I see. And then, so what about relevant? Because I thought that was the big deal in Section 215 of the Patriot Act. It says, oh, yeah, you can do this, that, and the other thing as long as it's relevant. And then they said relevant means not relevant. Relevant means whatever we feel like. And that was what got Sensenbrenner so angry that he wanted to do something about this, right? So did at least the original version actually address that and say, actually, let us remind you what the definition of the word relevant is or anything along those lines?
No, they never tried to redefine the word relevant. The original bill, like I said, tried to just tie any collection of evidence to an actual investigation. This bill tries to...
Am I right, though, that that was part of what Sensenbrenner was so outraged about in the first place?
Yeah, but just as an example, the new bill says once you've collected this information off of selectors, you have to destroy it within 5 years unless it is... unless it is relevant to a terrorist investigation. So it uses that same standard. In other words, you know, the only rule that NSA has to destroy this data basically says, using that same relevant language, and this is Sensenbrenner who wrote this, mm-hmm. who's all up in arms about relevant, they say, well, you know, you don't have to destroy this data if it is relevant to an investigation, but they wouldn't have even had it except for this argument that it's relevant. So, you know, basically, once the NSA gets your data via this new system, they can keep it as long as they want, forever.
Good times. All right. It's the brilliant Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net. She dissects all this stuff for you there. We'll be right back after this ridiculously long break.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And I got the great Marcy Wheeler on the phone. Empty Wheel is what they call her online. That's emptywheel.net. And, of course, on Twitter as well, at Empty Wheel. And not so empty, full of information and insight here. Yeah, that was kind of lame, but anyway. So, Marcy, tell me, before we get to the timing of all of this, the USA Freedom Act, is there anything else along the lines of what could have been in the original version of the Freedom Act that has now been watered down that we need to cover here?
One thing that I think is really important is they had some really good inspector general reports that require – they basically – the DOJ inspector general is now reviewing the Section 215 use through 2009. And the old USA Freedom said, okay, now do the ones since 2009. And for those, we want you to tell us basically how many Americans you've collected on, and we want to tell us if you've broken the rules. They also included a bunch of new reports that required the government to tell specifically what they were getting with Section 215 reports, and those are all seriously watered down in the USA Freedom Act. So first of all, there's a gap. So whereas the old USA Freedom Act would have given you continuous IG reporting up until now. Mm-hmm. The new one basically leaves 2010 and 2011 as a whole in the IG reports. And I don't know if they plan to pick that up somewhere else, but there's some reasons to believe that those years would be of particular interest. And that's how we learn about these programs. But also the reporting has been totally watered down so that the government doesn't have to tell Congress how many people are affected by these programs. And that's the really ironic thing. They're saying, oh, we're fixing bulk collection, but they refuse to provide reports that would allow Congress to actually assess whether they're still getting bulk collection.
Yeah, it's still just take their word for it. No semi-independent IG, or at least not with a real mandate.
Like, I mean, just as an example, right now, the national security letters, the national security letters on their congressional reports are the only one that have to say how many U.S. persons or how many individual people are, you know. So there were like 15,000 national security letters last year. Something like 8,000 individuals were assigned. Internal reports tell Congress how many of those were U.S. persons, and they'll break down what kind of national security letters there were. And then there's a whole part of the national security stuff, the national security letter stuff that's exempted, that just gets basically phone book data, and that they don't have to report that to Congress. But there's no equivalent level of detail at the business record, so that, you know, now they would report, well, we have four orders involved with the phone dragnet, and those collect 310,000 people. That there's no measure of how many people are affected by each order. And that, I think, is telling. I mean, if they're not willing to share that information, it says they're still engaged in bulk collection.
Right.
And there's one other really important thing for your listeners to know about.
Sure.
Right now, the Patriot Act is due to expire next June, so not much more than a year away. And that should give reformers some kind of leverage, because they know if we get to June and nothing happens, then reformers are just going to let it drop, and then NSA doesn't have any access. And the USA Freedom Act basically pushes the sunset for the Patriot Act out to 2017. And it would coincide with the FISA Amendments Act, but it would also mean, you know, another, you know, seriously, we're talking about being 16 years after 9/11 and still have these emergency measures in place.
Right. Okay, now, so before we get back to the politics of it, because I do want to talk about that, but can you tell me about the part about the financial institution? Because I think I remember it used to be an outrage what was being required of actual financial institutions in, you know, warrantless executive-only requests for information. But then they went, and I guess ever since September 11th, maybe more and more and more now, they keep identifying or redefining financial institution to mean anybody with $5 in their pocket, I think. What is all that?
Yeah, that's one of the sketchy things about the changes. I mean, let me take three steps back. One is one of the primary orders for the business records program has been released in part, and it makes it clear that they have used Section 215 to get financial records. That one was purportedly tied to a specific investigation, so, you know, say Anwar al-Awlaki rather than every potential terrorist sympathizer. So we do know they've used Section 215 for financial reports. New York Times and Wall Street Journal have reported that the CIA has also used it for money transfer companies. But we're just not seeing a lot of visibility on that. One of the interesting things that had been in the original USA Freedom Act was they laid out precisely what was included under those financial entities that could be forced to turn over information, and it should have been. I mean, these were all always closely tied. That should have been clear by the legislative language anyway. But for some reason, they felt like they needed to spell out what got included as a financial entity or not, and that's been removed too. And it does make me wonder whether what you just said is happening, which is that anybody who does anything with money is being called a financial institution and therefore being served national security letters to get this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think they at first expanded it to mean, well, car dealers or boat dealers or maybe jewelers or anybody who's selling big ticket items, that counts because it could be a financial instrument in a way if you sort of twist it, but not really. And once you allow that, then pretty much you've allowed financial institution to mean whatever they want. So from there, it's just sliding down the slippery slope. And I don't know if it's gone as far as I'm speculating there either, but I don't know what would stop them at this point. And I guess not the new Freedom Act anyway.
No, and you know, minor point, but the USA Freedom Act had also eliminated a way, or had kind of made it, there's two ways to get credit reports, one of which is limited to terrorism, and the USA Freedom Act had gotten rid of that dualism and put some new restrictions on what you had to do to get a full credit report on somebody, and that's out the window too. So, you know, so it's just some things that We don't know why they were in the USA Freedom Act in the first place because we don't know enough about what FBI is doing. But, you know, when you see things like that, they're there for a reason. And whatever reason they're there for, the intelligence community wants to keep because they've gotten that thrown out of the bill.
In other words, some staffer was concerned and said, you know what should really be in there is this. And we only see that side of it. We don't know what secret they know, but we could see the correction they're trying to make and then see their correction go out the window, too.
Right. I mean, one thing that we know from the President's Review Group and from this, from both the USA Freedom Act and from Freedom Act, is that everyone believes the government is using NSLs, national security letters, for what you and I would consider bulk collection. And it's not clear how they're doing it. It's not clear what they're doing. We don't know. We just know that, for example, the President's Review Group said you need to eliminate bulk collection for national security letters the same way you need to eliminate it for Section 215. And the NSLs, that's one of the areas where the bill has changed the most, is they've gotten rid of a lot of the good aspects of that. There used to be IG reports required for the national security letter practice. That's out. That's been eliminated. So it's troubling because that's the area where we don't have Snowden documents that tell us what's going on. And that may well be where, I mean, first of all, you know, I've said this before, but as worried as I am about NSA, I'm far more worried about FBI. And we don't have visibility into what FBI is doing. And the notion that FBI is doing this kind of mapping based on financial information and the like should be troubling to everyone.
Right. I mean, we see little stories here and there about every county sheriff wants in on this same kind of game to the degree that he can. So when it comes to the FBI, you can be sure they're doing as much as they possibly can. Anyway, whatever that might be, they're not the NSA, but they certainly have a lot of authority, if not all of the capability. But now,
well,
so,
and really importantly, the NSA still has rules about, because they're allegedly a foreign intelligence entity, right? Mm-hmm. So they still have fairly strict rules about how they're supposed to protect U.S. person data. The FBI has nothing like that. I mean, their job is to share information as broadly as they can, and that includes sharing with other agencies like DEA, but also sharing down to local levels. You know, by rushing through the House Judiciary bill with the House intelligence bill kind of lurking behind as a threat, it is getting people who have no sane reason to support this to support it.
Right.
And that's the concern, because you're right, no civil libertarian should support this, but I think people are because of the way the parliamentary tactics are working.
Well, sometimes compromises are worth it, but it doesn't sound like it in this case. I'm sorry, we're so over time. I got to go, but thank you so much for your time as always. I really appreciate it, Marcy.
Relevant members of the Senate. And that's really what they did, is they just explained the facts of life to these committees who are investigating the question of reducing or eliminating the restrictions on Israeli visas here.
Right. The visa thing. Well, first of all, could you elaborate about that? The bill that looked like it was going to pass there for a while, right?
It's been up in the air for some time. Many Israelis who want to come to the United States who do not qualify for extended visas here for one reason. Two is that Israel discriminates against Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans going to Israel. And these are the two main considerations in the visa various varieties of the visa legislation under consideration on the Hill. But recently, as I reported, U.S. security officials briefed the House Judiciary Committee. Actually, there have been a number of briefings, and any member who wants a briefing can have one. And some have had individual briefings, is my understanding, on the levels of Israeli espionage here. And it's been frightening to some members of Congress.
All right. Now, it's interesting. Some of the adjectives you use in the story here about just how astonished the staff and
weapons systems, intelligence, which my sources have said they take home and improve on and, you know, then resell. if not used for their own defensive purposes. So they the whole range, the whole gamut of U.S. technological and military secrets that they can use to their advantage, as well as keeping an eye on what other intelligence services and agents have any independent knowledge of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think Cameron's paraphrase was even really saying that, but just that they knew about these guys in the country, that they were up to something, that they weren't sharing everything they knew with the FBI, that kind of thing. I don't think he ever said that they must have known the day and time and place of the attack and this and that kind of deal, but I understand what you mean, though. But anyway, it is an interesting question, and it does hang there. And so now I wonder about this, Jeff. Is this kind of a big deal, do you think, that Congress is apparently so astonished?
Not good enough. Although Congress could legislate to some degree a removal of visa restrictions, there are steps that a country has to go through with the Department of Homeland Security. It has to meet certain criteria, reporting requirements on, for example, lost and stolen passports.
Countries how about this? I mean, is there an earlier time where something like this wouldn't have been controversial because not that there was any less?
These are not special steps for Israel. These are special steps for any country, and it can take a number of years. It took Chile, which is certainly a close friend of ours now. It took Chile 3 years to qualify for lifting visa restrictions. Again, there is a bureaucratic course that Israel has to go through, and it hasn't even applied to go through that. It's announced that a delegation from the foreign ministry is coming here to...
Then he just said, hey, all right. Which is all right. Hey, Darren, how's it going, man? Hey, everybody else, too. All right, so that's more or less the show for today. One more segment here. Oh, man, I should have set up the phone thing for y'all to call in the phone thing. Oh, well, don't worry. I got plenty to complain about. We'll do calls tomorrow or the next day or something. You guys ever want to do calls on the show, man? Call in the dang show. Man, I got so much to talk about and not enough time. There are going to be attacks in Europe and in the United States, and it's just laws and numbers. And, of course, the FBI will be too busy chasing young girls kidnapped in Nigeria and entrapping idiots into saying Osama and a tape recorder here in America to do anything about it, too. To do anything to stop it, just like last time. And so I hereby predict attacks. They're coming. It's just laws and numbers. I've been trying to tell you to not do the things the politicians, they do. The Iraq invasion. The Libyan one. The Syrian jihad. Wage of war in Afghanistan all these years. That hadn't helped either. Whole new generations. Bin Laden was making fun of us, too, back in 2004. He said, look, man, you guys could knock this off at any time, but the only people benefiting here are me and my movement and a few politically connected companies who are cashing in at the expense of the rest of y'all. But for the rest of y'all, it's national suicide. What are you doing? Why are you letting them get away with doing this to you? Might have taken his advice. And this is how to win the war on terrorism and get it done. And then further down the path to national suicide we go, or we just call it off. Because if we call it off, the whole terror war, our whole Middle East policy, the support for these guys will dry up. Because here's the clue about Al-Qaeda that you never knew before. These guys are really horrible, and everywhere they go, everybody hates them. And the only reason that anybody would tolerate them at all is to help them fight their mortal enemies. So the Sunni insurgents in Iraq... Fine, if the suicide bombers want to help fight the Americans and the Shiites, then okay. But when they're no longer useful and became a burden, blam. It was not David Petraeus' bribes. The Sunni awakening existed long before they ever called it that. From the very beginning of 2006, from probably pretty much right around the time they killed Zarqawi on. The local Sunni tribe said, all right, thanks, guys, but you've actually not helped us very much. You've been more harm than good, and now beat it. You bother me. And they were marginalized. They go to Syria, and everywhere they go, they're cutting off people's hands. They shot a 14-year-old kid in the face for not even insulting Mohammed, but just bringing up his name in a way that was not actual prayer. It was like, oh, come on. Even Mohammed would have to pay full price for some pecans at this pecan stand or something like that. It was just the most innocuous thing. Bland, they murdered him in front of his mom. And of course, the cannibalism and the beheadings and this and that. And as Coburn describes in great deal, their absolute pathological hatred of the Shia. And that creates, you know, that just helps bring Hezbollah across the border from Lebanon to help protect the Shia. That only helps increase Iranian and Iraqi support for the Syrian counter-jihad against these guys. But otherwise, their support dries up quick when they don't have somebody to fight. And if America and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and when Saudi and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan, when they're, you know, funding and supporting the jihad in Syria, that's America doing it. And that's America asked them to do it, and that's America could ask them to stop at any time and doesn't. So don't pretend to believe for a moment that, oh, if only Qatar would stop backing the jihadists in Syria or whatever, because that might be somebody's talking point somewhere, but it ain't the truth. It's all an American project. That's just the slightest bit of, you know, so-called plausible deniability, but not very plausible to me. And, you know, maybe they convinced themselves that a regime change against Gaddafi would not result in expanded power and authority very much for al-Qaeda types in Libya, and maybe they were shocked and surprised to find out just how radical the beneficiaries of the war have been. But to support, ultimately, to support ISIS and al-Nusra in Syria is treason and suicide. It's such a bad move. It's a really bad move. And I don't care who has what agenda. The Israelis or anybody else hates Assad for any other reason. For America to be backing al-Qaeda guys against him or anyone else in the world is absolute madness. Oh, and someone in the chat room asked, I would have to see something better than that Iranian news source for shipping these guys to Ukraine. Show me some actual evidence of that, but I don't know, anything's possible, I guess. Anyway, I gotta go. I'm all out of time, but go read Patrick Coburn. Read Patrick Coburn. Okay, see you tomorrow.